It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI.
And today's conversation is going to focus on neurology, neuroscience, art, and the intersection between neuroscience and art. And Krista, you want to introduce our guests?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited to have you both here today. So with us, we have Kinder Crick, who is an artist, and Dr. Gilles Patel, a neuroscientist.
And that creates a really interesting intersection because Kendra, you started life in the world of science and you have a whole life with doing art at the intersection of neuroscience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Hi, well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here. But so I have been doing, I guess, creating all my life. When I was young, I was considered to be an artist because I enjoyed representing the world on paper. Three dimensions on two dimensions. I was raised, I guess, I'm just an insatiable, curious person. And so I enjoyed science and I was sort of encouraged down that path and pursued, sort of traditional path of math, science, at the same time doing art in the background. and at some point, I decided to sort of merge those two worlds. One of the kind of privileges of being someone who gets to look under a microscope is that you get to kind of these worlds that are available to you. At the same time, kind of my creative endeavors in making things, I wanted to kind of take that and bring it and make it available kind of out of that silo. So there's a very sort of strange path that led me there. And at some point relatively recently, I had sort of inklings of taking my background, which is mostly in molecular biology, but applying it to my interest in the human brain. And that is such a wonderful growing field. When I dive into a project, it usually starts with research, almost very similar to how I would start a research project when I was doing work in a lab. But this time kind of combining that with sort of a outcome that usually involves some form of imagery. So I will take images from the microscope, diagrams, and bring those to life. And I am a multimedia artist and sometimes play around with the medium in order to kind of be a component of my message, so.
Yeah, that's a perfect description of someone who really is what it should be, I think, in a way. People are at the intersection all the time of both. I think we specialize out sometimes, or we learn to not be one or the other of those. But I think it's more the norm that people are crossing back and forth all the time in that. Jill, I know in the work that you do, you're constantly crossing around in there because you really are on some of the cutting edge of trying to be creative about how do you explore what you're trying to do. Plus, how do you image? I mean, it's hard. How do you create an image of of what you think the brain is seeing or doing. Can you talk a little bit about your work?
Yeah. So thank you guys for having me. And I agree with what Kendra has mentioned, that that there is a lot of similarity between the two, between, you know, the art and science. And I think, like, at the core, it's the principles of what you do and how you reach the end goal is pretty much the same. And so for me, it's been, you know, a journey of when I started, the way that science is taught, a lot of it has to do with being very analytical. And, you know, you have the rules of, well, first you have to form your hypothesis that's based on all of your previous findings and research. And then you move on to actually figuring out how to answer those questions that will prove your hypothesis or nullify it. And I think the artistic side kind of comes out in how you are able to take everything that's already been found in science and ask new questions that, you know, you can still be analytical, but also very creative in exactly what you're asking. And then the second layer to that is the way that you actually answer those questions, especially now, there are so many different ways that you can answer the same exact question in neuroscience. And I often find that people are sometimes answering the same questions, but have now found more sophisticated techniques that will give you like an inch more than what you knew before. And I think that's all really cool, because I think, again, people are being creative in how they're answering questions and what techniques they use, right? So for me, my PhD work was in fear disorders. So that's a very, you know, I'm more interested in the behaviors and the, I guess, the abnormalities of behaviors in human beings. But the way we study that is by looking at the brain, and you're trying to figure out what's wrong in the brain. And that involves a lot of, you know, trying to image it in a way that you can actually visualize what's wrong, and very physically pinpoint where the issues may be so that you can find some sort of treatment for it. So yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between the two, and I try to incorporate that into my work. And I think it's getting more and more, I'd say, like, seamless because of how many different ways you can actually incorporate the two now, especially in science.
Kendra, as you were talking, and Jill, as you were talking, one of the things that I noticed was about how both of you engage in a type of integrative thinking, where you're bringing together, whether that's training or technique, from sort of multiple different angles to center around answering a question. So Kendra, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see your thought process as an artist, as integrating your previous experiences, previous techniques, et cetera.
I will say that this is sometimes a bit of a mystery to myself, because I would like to say that there was sort of an obvious thing. I do know that I start on a project with a lot of intense research. And let me give you the counterbalance to this, is that when I was younger, a lot of what I did and kind of in my training was around the figure and drawing the figure or a landscape. And at some point, I got very good at representing three dimensions in a two-dimensional space. And at some point, I get a little bored in the middle, because I'd know the ending. And I was like, this is no longer interesting to me. I wasn't challenged by simply putting what I saw onto the paper. And so part of what I enjoy is challenging myself in thinking, oh, is there a way that I can kind of create a space in which to make something? It'll be about something, you know, usually it'll be about something I have a deep interest in. I mean, I'll tell you currently, it sort of has gone from memory to memory and sleep, and then most recently, which hasn't made itself onto something tangible, is the circadian rhythm. So I'll go and I'll do a deep research into these areas. And then I'd say there's a ton of iteration there. So I will experiment in, you know, traditional sort of drawing, and then something will kind of click. And I can't tell you what that is, because when it happens, you sort of get this delight. Oh, wow, that sparked something. And then it's a matter of just sort of getting it onto, you know, sort of a metaphor, getting it onto the page. And so that is what I'm personally looking for, is that what transforms it to me into something where I get an energy from kind of this exploration that I've been doing, and then suddenly then translating. And then there's a whole process of getting feedback. So then showing it to people and then having them reflect back to you, because in my mind, a lot of what I like to play with, especially with neuroscience, is the neuroscience of perception. The fact that the viewer actually transforms your work. So I'll give a fun example. I enjoy optical illusions like the Necker cube. And so when I draw a Necker cube, it's just lines on a page. But when the viewer looks at it, they can actually make the Necker cube, the face, which ones come forward, it can flip and it can go back and forth. And so in a sense, they're actually interacting with this piece, even though I have set a very static image in front of them. And so there is this kind of engagement with your audience as a part of it, which then of course will go give me feedback. And then I kind of go on to my next project, because there's always this element of either performance or, you know, showing off what you've done. And so then you kind of necessarily need to say, well, what was reflected back to me? And kind of that sometimes builds into it. But to answer your question, I wouldn't say that there's a formula. I think that part of it is intuition, this idea of you get excited. And I have pieces that incorporate chalkboards, and the act of picking that medium for representing memory became interesting to me. Just trying to solve that problem of how is, you know, this surface of a chalkboard, how is that impermanent surface like memory? And so playing with those ideas, I say a lot of it is playful, and then at some point, you know, it delights me. And so hopefully that can come across also to the people who view my work. And all in the kind of inspiration of the research that I've kind of been diving into. So.
Thanks. I think that that's really helpful for our listeners to kind of get a sense about your process a little bit more. And I think I'll turn it over to Jill and ask you to talk about the ways in which you think about integrative thinking within the context of the scientific work that you do. I'm sure we're going to have follow-up questions, but it's helpful, I think, to hear the process from that lens. So, Jill, I know that neuroscience as a field, as you mentioned, is kind of a relatively young field from a sort of scientific perspective, that it pulls on multiple different scientific perspectives. So can you talk about how you sort of integrate ideas and concepts to be able to answer your research questions?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I am still pretty young in the field and in my career. So I would say my personal integrative thinking is very currently unstructured, and I would say almost unconscious. I know that there's integrative thinking involved in the process, but I haven't always been able to like articulate exactly how. But I will say that something that I have noticed is when you are going through the process of any sort of like scientific inquiry, even just coming up with the question initially, not just even doing the research, if you're just thinking about what exactly do you want to do research on, that for me was one of the biggest indicators of where that integrative thinking comes in. because you have to have some integration of your experiences in your past with other people, especially in neuroscience. I think that's relevant with other people, with animals, you know, whatever, with life outside. And that's where your questions usually come from. I would say that's relevant for science in general, is your questions are based off of what you experience in your life. And that's where my creative process, I think, comes from, is I can always tell after talking to people about different things, like whatever range of subjects, that I always come back to my science feeling a little bit more refreshed, because that's your unconscious, I think, coupling of, well, this is what my science is contributing to. You know, I'm talking to these people and I think that I can do something that would help them, or that would answer their questions, or their questions about people around them. So I think that's the biggest way I've noticed integrative thinking coming in, is formulating that initial question. And then the rest of it really for me is how, you know, the how of actually figuring out an answer to your question. You have a lot of avenues. And I think it depends on what kind of, how you want to present your data. So in science, I think this is really important. It's not really even a field, but the way you present your data matters a lot. And that's another concept that for me has been very important, because, you know, when we talk about things like science communication, or even probably Kendra's art, you could probably speak to this, that the way that you present things to the general public matters if you actually want them to engage and connect with whatever you're presenting. And absolutely, especially relevant in the world today, is if your research benefits people, then people should know what it's about and be able to talk to you about it. And I have found that art is one of the best ways to do that. And probably not as sophisticated as Kendra's, but you know, even the way that I present like my presentations in lab, I try to incorporate things that would help people at any level or from any field understand it. And that's another way that I think I'm currently trying to bring that integrative thinking into my research, so that I can have that engagement with the public and be able to communicate my science in a way that will actually have an impact, or at least get it out there, you know?
Thanks. Yeah, I think that that's so fascinating. Like I said, it really, for me, listening to both of you talk generates tons of other questions. But Mark, I know that you want to have an opportunity to ask them questions too. So I'm going to turn it back over to you while I kind of make sense of all of these great ideas.
I think that what you're both talking about, and it was interesting as we were doing, Kendra, you were nodding through part of what she was saying. So when we would start there, what were your reactions as Jill was talking about that end part that she was, you know, saying about her trying to integrate and using, in a sense, her form of art to do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the idea of I just love the idea of, you know, part of the hard work is doing the actual research and coming to conclusions. And then there's a whole another component of how do you take this amazing information and convey it to all different audiences, those who are in your field, those who come at and don't necessarily have the context in which to start from, maybe, and then be able to connect to show not only, you know, what the research is, but how it might impact them. And then also to engage, I mean, the most fun is to engage where you stimulate their curiosity to the point where they're thinking, oh, well, what's next? I mean, what else can we do? And that, I think, hearing Jill talk about that was like, oh yeah, absolutely. This is how you kind of ignite people's curiosity. And then, you know, you're sort of passing the torch, you know, being able to say, oh, this is really interesting. And, you know, that can kind of spark someone else's imagination. And that's how, you know, I do believe, you know, art in its form is a great way of, you know, stimulating engagement and disarming people in to some extent, allowing people an entry point where they may not, where they can feel welcome, maybe in a space that they are maybe would have felt uncomfortable, but you've taken down maybe some of the walls or the barriers by putting it into a different context. And in that way, everybody can kind of participate and maybe be a little less fearful of asking a question about, you know, asking about themselves. And I think maybe I'm preempting another discussion, but really, you know, knowing about ourselves and studying the brain, I mean, is fascinating. And I think that the fact that there is so many new ways to understand how the brain works, I mean, it just allows people to get maybe a little bit better understanding of themselves and those around them. And so I love the idea of scientists thinking about how to engage, you know, not only their peers, but those who may not have kind of the background and kind of being able to kind of make it more open, which then can inspire more people.
That's really, you know, exactly what I believe is the most important thing is the way in which the arts, not just only visual, but movement, all kinds, how those can create, and you use the word that I would use, which is entry points into understanding. And it's often not only for other people to in communicating, but for ourselves to communicate with ourselves. There's almost that inner voice. You were speaking a little of that inner voice, Jill, where you're having a dialogue with yourself about as you're trying to figure out the next step on something, you're going back and forth. And I think the arts can be very freeing to do that. I'd like to explore that when we come back. We've been talking to Kendra Crick and Dr. Jill Patel about the brain, creating works of art, and how there is a really strong and powerful intersection between the arts and science. Join us in a little bit after we take a break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about neuroscience and art with Kendra Crick and Dr. Jill Patel. And I know, Krista, you had some thoughts because this is your area, is science communication.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mark. So Kendra and Jill, one of the things that I know in my work around training scientists to communicate more effectively is that that fear and creativity are in that space of science communication, particularly if we're talking about communicating outside the boundaries of our expertise. And so, Gilles, I'm wondering if maybe we can start with you and ask you to talk a little bit about the sort of neuroscience of fear and how creativity might play into that, or how creativity might be helpful in that space.
Absolutely. So, generally speaking, when people usually talk about fear, it's especially even in the research realm of what I studied, it has more to do with like phobias, you know, negative experiences or traumatic events that will imprint a fearful memory that stays with you for a long period of time. And that is a like an event that you can, or at least in my research and in many, many other groups that are studying fear, they're able to usually pinpoint specific brain regions and at this point, a lot of different pathways and proteins that are involved that are very relevant to how those memories are formed, how they are maintained, and how they're brought back up whenever you're back in, you know, a similar environment where you first had that memory or first had that event occur. So that's what I study. But what you're talking about is the more creative aspect of it. And so I haven't studied creativity in the realm of fear, which sounds really cool actually, but I will mention that there are a lot of, I would say it's been more recent studies of how fear can be changed or influenced. The fearful behavior can be influenced in response to whether or not you have like a safety cue around you. So something that indicates that you will be fine or that you're not actually, you know, going to have a fearful event occur. And this is in like preclinical studies. So it's a new topic, fairly new topic, and is still being explored. But the idea of having your response, your fear response is kind of attenuated simply because there is something there that tells you that it won't be as bad. You know what I mean? And so that's still being explored, but the fear field basically, has a few key brain regions that are very important. What I studied was the amygdala, which is the most popularly known. People call it the fear center. It's not completely accurate because it is, first of all, responsible for a lot of other things, especially emotional processing. So I would think it also plays a role in creativity, most likely. And there's other brain regions that are then involved in like the circuitry via which you have fearful responses or memories imprinted. And that's where I'm going to leave it at to not make it too complicated, but that's
great though.
Yeah. The scientific side of fear.
Yeah. Because I think so. And this is one of the things I love about having these conversations, because we have this opportunity to talk about the science of this, like what's really happening in your brain when you encounter these really, you know, in some cases, terrifying events. And I also think as somebody who's taught public speaking for a number of years in her career, I don't teach it anymore, but I do to some extent still help scientists to, you know, communicate more effectively, that giving folks that sense of safety, whether that comes from an object or it comes from a conversation. One of my favorite, I used to actually teach a section of public speaking for speaking reticent individuals. So a whole class of folks who have had already failed public speaking twice because they were overwhelmed by anxiety. I mean, so like, it's a significant group of folks who really feel overwhelmed by these concepts. And each person was able to mitigate that fear and that anxiety in different ways. And I always saw my role in that classroom as finding what were the things that made that person feel safe and comfortable. And so I think about that as it relates to art and the idea that art is in part as a viewer sometimes designed to challenge you. But one of the ways I know, at least in working with artists, whether that's through the Da Vinci Pursuit or even my own artistic pursuits, that it is that mix of sort of, this is a kind of education term, but challenge and support, right? Like we want to challenge you, but we also want to bring in these images and ideas and experiences that have a sense of comfort to them in some way. So I'm wondering, Kendra, if you can talk about, as you think about creativity and you talk about how creativity develops in people as an artist, how do you think about the relationship between being creative and also maybe to some extent censoring some of that fear that we face?
Right. Oh, that's so great. I just love conversations like these. Because and the act of making, and then also I think the act of showing kind of what you've made inherently has this idea of, you know, it can be, you know, revealing. And in a sense that also, if you're doing something, which I can only relate my own experience, like one of the things I thought was odd is when I started creating imagery of cells, a lot of the people around me at school, in art school, sort of didn't have a context for that. And I thought it was really odd. So there wasn't maybe that support system. And I thought, and most people would sort of reflect back to me, oh, are those flowers? And I was like, no, fibroblasts. But, and so there was this kind of, you know, not necessarily moving forward in terms of exploring, you know, art and science. But once I found a community where there were other people who sort of spoke my language, I think that there was that support and also the feedback kind of, you know, just you, sometimes you just need a little energy, and you can get that from your sort of art community. But, you know, this idea of being able to present things in a, you know, I guess you were saying it's safe space. I mean, that might be a component of it, but there's also sort of maybe a little bit of that not seeing things as precious. I think that's another component to creativity, is not needing to be perfect. And so one of the practices that I just have sort of employed myself, or I have seen taught to others, is sort of creating things with iteration, with this idea that, meh, you know, this is just an idea. It doesn't have any, it doesn't need to stick. It's in my sketchbook. And then this idea of, oh, actually, maybe that was a good idea, and kind of exploring that. But reducing the stakes, and that can be a different way of maybe saying that something is safe, right? The material you're using isn't that precious. The outcome doesn't have, you know, huge implications. And therefore, you actually kind of give more, you know, a more space to explore. And then I will tell you, in one of my hats that I wear is I work with an arts integrated neuroscience outreach group, which pairs artists and usually graduate students and postdocs together so they can give a talk. And one of the reasons why we do it in a pub setting, even though it's kind of to a lay audience, is to create a low stakes atmosphere so that people can practice talking in front of others. And it's kind of fun. And that playfulness, I think, can be used in making art, you know, reducing the stakes. And that can kind of, I guess, enable that. I don't know how this relates to fear. Maybe Jill, you can speak to this. You know, kind of it changes the dynamics in which things are being made. So that was a lot, but I don't know if you want to respond, Jill.
Yeah, I was gonna add that I think what you're describing is that you're kind of inhibiting the fear in a way that, because you're in a setting where everyone is on the same level essentially, and there are no strings attached. Like there's no, you're not going to be graded on this at the end of, you know, one of your science outreach events. You're not there. You don't have to learn if you don't want to. And I think that's actually what pushes people, because then the people who are actually there are intrinsically interested to just learn about whatever you're teaching. And if you're able to communicate it in a way that they understand it, they're probably going to keep coming back. And that's I think what a lot of science outreach, I mean, the stuff that we do in Indy with Da Vinci Pursuit, we do something similar. I work with a small group of people that puts on Taste of Science. I don't know if you've heard of it, but we also do going to pubs and breweries and bringing scientists in to talk about whatever they're doing. And it brings in a ton of people who, so far, most of them are not scientists. but they just have an interest in learning whatever it is, what through whatever connection they have to the topic. And so I think that's a good way to describe it, is that you're inhibiting the fear, and there's no, like, you're not selling them anything. You're just telling them to come and just engage with a beer, which I think anyone would want to do.
Right.
One of the things that's really exciting about what you both are talking about is the community-based or the communal, the humanness, the connection that needs to exist in order for these things to happen, right? So I've mentioned, and Mark mentioned earlier, that I use a bunch of improv theater techniques to often teach about this work. And one of the sort of very old axioms of improv theater is bring a brick, not a cathedral. Right? The idea that if you come with the fully formed cathedral and want to engage with others about it, again, those stakes are so high. You've put so much work into that cathedral. But if instead you come with this pile of bricks and you work together with your audience or others to sort of build something new in community together, you're more likely to get good feedback on your ideas. You're more likely to feel that sense of community and feel that sense of growth that you get from feedback, which I think is a really affirming experience that we all as humans have.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, you were both talking a little bit and hinting at, particularly Kendra, that idea that we sometimes need to find the energy. And we find that often in another individual. So what's really interesting is you can paint a painting, finish it, but it's in the gallery show sometimes that you find the energy to go do something else, or to even go back and revisit something that you did. And I know, Jill, that's the same. You present something even to a colleague in your work setting, and you can see that energy, that excitement that they get. And while it may not be them that's going to do that additional work, it's inspiring to you, or they may just say one little thing. And so it's that energy loop. Many people who are actors, when I would act on stage, it was the same way. We used to call them good or bad audiences, because good audiences, you draw energy, they give you energy. The other audiences that are just really there, you know, that kind of like Sunday afternoon matinee after a, you know, big lunch, they're just not with you very often. And so it's really hard to act because you can't pull that. So I love that. I love that idea of it's this relationship with many other people that help to build, I think, and also to decrease the fear that you were talking about, Jill, in your thing. So that's really exciting. Kendra, I wonder if you would describe a little bit of what you're working on right now in terms of your art pieces.
Well, it's been an interesting year because showing things, most of the time I enjoy sort of interactive engagement. So this year has been a little bit different. So I would say that I would be percolating more on my interests. So for example, what I'm interested in right now hasn't necessarily manifested in a way that I think is what, I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like, but I have previous interests in sleep and memory. And most recently, sort of my, I don't know, intense fascination, I guess you would call it, is in the circadian rhythm. And I can't tell you when I started becoming interested in this. It's sort of, I think sort of, it percolates in with sleep. And then of course, I think I read a book by Dr. Sachin Panda, who is out of the Salk Institute. And again, I have an affinity for the Salk Institute because I once worked there. And that, in terms of kind of influencing what I'm thinking about, you know, that humans, you know, have a day cycle and a night cycle, and this is very important to the brain. And that when you do something actually matters. And I'll just For a radio audience, I'll describe this. I think one of the manifestations is just a brain here. And you'll see one of the hemispheres of the brain, so it's kind of 3D printed, is daylight, sort of a little bit of allusion to Magritte. And then you have the nighttime. And I have put on here sort of constellations that just also happen to be neurotransmitters that are higher during when people sleep. Acetylcholine, and again, just because I have sort of this interest in night and day. And again, very simple. This is kind of, to me, a sketch, right? I have the brain, I have the night, I have the day. It's sort of a way to kind of organize my thoughts. And it's an object that I've created. So that's sort of, in my mind, sort of one piece of this. But in the background, I also should be saying is that for the past year, I've been recording my sleep. And so that in itself might manifest itself. But I would say that I'm kind of in the discovery phase, meaning that I am collecting information, learning more about this. This is kind of an interesting area, relating it to what I know about other interests of mine, such as dreams and memory. And then eventually this will, quote unquote, make its way into a project or onto the page, so to speak. So I would say that in this past year, I've been working on sort of the collecting of information, if that makes sense. And mostly just because part of how I work is in showing work, and I enjoy showing and having people interact with it. And engage with it in creating a space for it. And that hasn't been as available this past year. So does that?
Yeah, that more than answers what I think that shows even more the intersection between what artists and scientists do that are very similar. and you know, that you used that word percolating. And yet I think that's what all of us do, is ideas have to percolate. They have to sit there, and they don't always come on command. They often not, but they can, but they do come from, I think, the research could even be observing in the world more. And if I found anything that helped me during COVID was, it was a time of more introspection, but more looking and learning and examining during this time than I ever did, because I couldn't be out in the world. I had to bring the world in, but the world that I was choosing to bring in. So that's sort of what you're saying about where it is. I'm going to really love to see where that takes you. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further in conversation with others, including your family, any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show. And we'll be right back.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone. Connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Welcome back. We're having conversations about the intersection of neuroscience and art. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton. So Kendra and Jill, you know, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the sort of relationship between the pandemic and how the pandemic has changed so much of our work and the way our work happens in community with others. And Kendra, I know you have an interesting process as an artist that is about kind of communicating with others and getting feedback from audiences. Can you talk about how your work changed during the pandemic?
I can touch a little bit on that. I will say that artists do work in isolation typically. I mean, they can work in their studio. And again, there are collaborations and things like that. But one of the things that one sometimes assumes that is going to be part of the creative process is presenting your work in some ways to other people so that they can engage. And part of that engagement is providing feedback and kind of that, you know, seeing the work being completed by having someone respond to it. And then kind of, so the art world, some parts of the art world, you know, is about these bringing images or performances to an audience. And so in this past year, you know, these places that we would gather, like museums or galleries or even performance spaces, those were disrupted. So I did do a few things that were virtual, but I'm not sure if there was that full range of experiencing. And also what was missing, which I kind of found interesting, was the opportunity to gather and have real enriched person-to-person contact where, you know, you see someone, not only their voice, their face, but their presence, and being able to respond to that. A lot of this past year has been more virtual, and that has changed things. I think different types of connections were made, but I think that some of the joy of gathering was altered, I guess, in the past year.
Jill, I'm seeing you nod, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, as a scientist, you know, again, I think, you know, there's that sense of community that comes from being in a lab. There's certainly a lot of individual thinking work that you do. How did your work change with the pandemic?
I feel like my personal experiences, but I also think a lot of other scientists and their experiences last year were parallel to what Kendra is talking about. So scientists, they work in isolation as well, but I would say the place that I worked in was very communal in the sense of I would be doing something, and if something went wrong or I didn't know what was happening, I could just call someone over and they would help me fix it. You know, there's a lot of like group work going on with anything that I was doing at that time. And there were some hard stops to those kinds of things. You know, we had to shut down our lab at one point and not be physically in there. We had limitations on how many people could be there. So, you know, we did the best we could and pivoted to online, like Kendra was saying, where if something went wrong, I could call someone or I could FaceTime them. And, you know, it worked out just fine. But I think the biggest impact is the settings where you get together with people. And it's different when you get to do that in person, because we've also had a lot of Zoom conferences and they're just not the same. And I think people are figuring that out more now, you know, incorporating like breakouts, breakout sessions or breakout rooms where you can have more one-on-one conversations. But when I was attending them, it was, here's a speaker, you're going to listen to them, and then you're going to go off and take a break inside of your house. So it was, I think I really missed that ability to get together with people that I haven't even met before, and actually being able to just talk, you know, and that doesn't happen as freely in a Zoom seminar. So, and that's also where a lot of ideas come from. My conferences were one of the best places where it's an enriched setting. Like you said, and there's neuroscience research on this too. I mean, there's research showing that like, if you keep, you know, if you're more socialized, or when you look at, you know, rodent research, when you keep them in a cage with a bunch of their other siblings, they grow up in a different way. And have a different set of behavioral outcomes than if they're single housed, for example, or if they're put in, an enriched setting where they have all these tubes and like playthings and toys and stuff, that makes a huge difference. And that's kind of how I look at conferences. I get to go somewhere and I get to play around with things that people are trying to sell. And I get to talk to people about their research, and it's just a completely different experience. And again, I think it has to do with how your brain is able to develop in isolation or do whatever it does in isolation compared to what it does in a community. And I think those are both equally important, but the fact that people were essentially forced to only be in isolation all of last year is what has been taxing, I think, for many, many people.
Yeah, and I really think for those that do a lot of creative work, which is something that I do, that the, I used to hang out in coffee shops and bars, and just parts of my day, that was where my office was. And there wasn't any reason other than there, I would hear conversations being fly on the wall. They might hear me talking on my cell phone and ask me, what are you talking about? I'd find out who they were, and then I could incorporate them into some of our work. And so I would make contacts, and I would get ideas, and I would hear stories. And it can't be, there was nothing that replaced that. Zoom doesn't have that casualness of your in the same way. And while it's worked, I think it was really good. Kendra, I know that artists can be alone, but I also know that often artists still need somebody who is in another studio nearby, or people drop by, or something, you know, there is still that, or out in the world, you are getting a cup of coffee and somebody knows you and you go, what are you working on? And you do, there is something about that creative process that is fed by others.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, one of the things, and again, art itself does this, is sort of disrupts pathways, you know, sort of if you have a rut and you've kind of, I mean, I was sort of thinking about, you know, what I enjoy about art, slight tangent, but it sort of wakes up the zombie, right? Like you have a certain path or maybe sort of habits or things that you do. And one of the things that other people do, changing your path does, is it quite literally changes how you think about something. So someone reflecting back, your reflecting an idea, and then having them kind of hear it, put it through their thought process, reinterpret it, and then reflect something back to you. This is kind of a crucible. It's an active kind of creation that's happening through simple conversations and sort of bumping around ideas. And it breaks your kind of everydayness. And it creates, you know, all, you know, just kind of a greater variety of ideas. So I would say that as an artist, one of the things that I do is I do gather friends when I'm coming up with something, or if I'm trying to puzzle something out, because having a sounding board is always important, especially with sort of your trusted people who've known you for a while and things like that. And that was definitely kind of disrupted, I could say, this year, because in a sense, you want to have things in your life which are unexpected, and people do that for you. And art does that in some ways. It's a bit of a disruptor, causes you to have to confront, maybe see something differently. But, you know, people, you know, just these acts of engagement, you know, that's very important. I think that's important to scientists, to make sure that they're not kind of trapped in
their own feedback,
you know, their own kind of rut. And again, when talking about making great leaps, sometimes it will just be someone reinterpreting what you said. You think you communicated something. You're like, oh, I had this great idea. And then they'll reflect back to you what you heard. And you're like, oh, wait, oh, that's really interesting. You know what I mean? It allows for a different way of seeing. And sometimes you need those people. And again, whether it's going to be in a coffee shop or if it's going to be at a conference or it's going to be at a gallery, you know, I do think that we benefit from these places that we gather.
What's really stimulating in what both of you are saying is this idea that, in a way, it's that collaboration with others. And collaboration is a two-way street, and you get this kind of feedback, and then you give feedback, and you don't know how you're affecting someone else, and you don't know how they're going to affect you until all of a sudden it does. And I think that's the beauty of this intersection between art and science, is that I think it can cause artists and scientists and people who are just listening to it or learning about it to jump out just a little bit and have new questions. I want to thank both Kendra Crick and Dr. Jill Patel for helping us explore this really amazing intersection, I think, between neuroscience and the arts. We'll look at our website, Krista. People can check in.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the cool things that we do is that you'll find pictures of Kendra and Jill's projects and those of other guests at the Da Vinci Pursuit website, which is thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls. So artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.